An emotional search for answers tonight in the disappearance of an Indianapolis mother. It has been nearly 5 years since Jessica Masker was last seen. Tonight, our Alan Carter shows us her family's new plea for help.
This is not the way they wanted to celebrate this birthday.
As we know, if she was here, we would be celebrating, but it is emotional. It hurts.
Through that pain, the family of Jessica Masker holds out hope, as they've done every year since she was reported missing nearly 5 years ago.
She turns 29 today, and
these days are difficult, and really every day since Masker was last seen April 15th, 2013, and not a whisper since.
We all think that there's foul play involved, but because of her drug habit, they don't want to do nothing about it because she's over 18.
There's been absolutely nothing real that was pertaining to her towards any tips or leads or any sightings or anything with my sister.
But hope is incredibly powerful.
We're going to say a prayer, and then I'm going to count to three.
We need to bring our daughter, our family, my baby girl home.
One, two, three.
Happy birthday, baby.
Everyone misses her. We don't just wish for closure. You know, hopefully my sister is still here, and none of us will ever give up.
In Indianapolis, Alan Carter, Channel 13 Eyewitness News.
This is Mark. I write a weekly newspaper column about true crime, unsolved homicides, and the paranormal. You can find links to my social media accounts and columns on my website titled themarkhopp.com. Welcome to the Catch My Killer podcast, and thank you for listening. Before I get into this week's podcast episode, I would like to ask for your help. I'm looking for listeners to help support the podcast by buying me a cup of coffee. If you would like to help support the podcast, I'm asking you to subscribe to my monthly crime coffee club, which is only $5 per month. If you subscribe to my monthly coffee fund, I will share exclusive content with you, and eventually commercial-free episodes and extra episodes. And if you enjoy reading about true crime stories, I will also share some really interesting ones with you. If you would like to support the podcast, please visit catchmykiller.com and click on either the donate link or on the buy me a coffee link. And that's enough of the coffee business. Now it's time to talk about this week's crime story. This week's story involves the disappearance of a young woman named Jessica Masker. She disappeared in 2013, and no one has seen or heard from her since. Her sister Christina has spent the past 8 years trying to find out what happened to her sister on April 15th, 2013. Jessica's aunt had given her a ride to her cousin's residence. After Jessica arrived at her cousin's house, the two argued. Jessica left and walked to a BP gas station at 5061 East Washington Street in Indianapolis. After she arrived, she called her brother for a ride. Her last words to her brother were that two men came at her wrong. He told his sister he couldn't get her, and then he asked her to call their mother for a ride home. After Jessica left the gas station, no one ever saw or heard from her again. I also want to mention that the area is a dangerous part of Indianapolis, often frequented by drug dealers and prostitutes. The reason I mentioned the address of the gas station and Jessica's brother is I wanted to clear up some incorrect information that's been released to the public. Various websites have incorrectly stated that Jessica vanished in the 2100 block of Napoleon after calling her mother from the gas station. She actually called her brother and was last seen on Washington Street. Not Napoleon. But for unknown reasons, Jessica didn't ask her mother for help. She left the gas station for an unknown destination. Jessica Masker vanished 8 years ago. What happened to her? The family filed a missing persons report on her, but so far, it has produced no results. Christina told me that Jessica would never abandon her family. Jessica also had two children. Christina fears that someone may have abducted Jessica. The family has so many questions and no answers. To better understand Jessica's disappearance, it's best to probably explain what led up to her disappearance. Jessica had a drug problem and became the mother of two children at an early age. To complicate matters more, one was born premature. She also struggled with maintaining employment and finding a good relationship. Before Jessica disappeared, she was involved in an abusive relationship with an older man. He is also the father of her second child. Although Jessica had many problems, her family always loved and supported her. Whenever Christina shares Jessica's story, she believes that people will often unfairly judge her sister. They may think that just because Jessica had a drug problem, her life wasn't meaningful. Christina wants the public to know that Jessica's life matters. She's still a mother, daughter, sister, and friend to many. Although Jessica disappeared 8 years ago, her family remains hopeful that she is somewhere out there still alive. I ask that you share this story and keep an eye out for Jessica Masker. For this episode, I spoke to her sister, Christina Masker. I also spoke to Jessica's closest friend, Kira Brox, and Detective Ron Cole, the Indianapolis Police Department.
My sister's name is Jessica Masker. A lot of us call her Jessie. I don't think I've ever called her Jessica. I've always said Jessie. She's 32 years old. Her birthday is March 18, 1989. She went missing April 15th of 2013. That's actually the official date she was put on the missing persons list. Law enforcement had told us that we had to wait a certain amount of time to get her officially on the list for them to start looking for her because she's an adult for one. And with her background with drugs, because she was actively doing drugs, they said we had to wait this time frame before they could put her on that list. We all know the first 24 to 72 hours is the most important time when a person, you know, they're not present, that they're missing, that something's happened. We didn't know what to do. So we took that into our own hands around that time. We were calling everywhere, asking all of our friends. It got to a point where we called the hospitals, jails, trying to figure out, where is she? Jessie was officially reported on the 15th. It was a few days before then that we had gotten contact with law enforcement about her. So she had just turned 24 years old when she went missing. Her birthday is in March. She went missing in April. There's eight of us siblings. There's five boys and us three girls. Only seven of us grew up together in the same household. We lived on the east side of Indianapolis. My sister, she is a loud, outgoing person. She loved doing hair. She had so many friends. Everyone knew Jessica. She loved hanging out with them. Jessie had got held back twice in elementary school. They found out she was partially deaf in one of her ears. She had got held back twice. By the time I made it to the fourth grade, we were in the same grade. Me and Jessie are about a year and 8 months apart or something like that. So once we were in fourth grade, we were inseparable. We had classes together. People were like, are they twins? And I'm like, we don't look alike, you know, just that sister thing. Jessie was just the life of the party. You always knew when she came in the room. She's a loving, amazing person. Around the time she had got in seventh or eighth grade, my sister had continuously asked my mom to sign her out of school and get her GED because she was years older than these other kids, and my mom let her sign out. She started classes for her GED. I cannot remember if she had finished or not. I do remember around that time she became pregnant with her first kid, and she had an amazing relationship with the father. And later on, Jessie had struggled with getting and keeping a job, so she had turned to stripping and got introduced to drugs. And the father of her child that she was with at that time was not okay with it. And they just both went their own ways. I'm not sure exactly how long after they had separated, he was stripping. But after they broke up, she was stripping. She was introduced to people dealing drugs. Just from there, everything went downhill. She had got introduced to this guy, and he became her boyfriend. He was her drug provider. This man was twice her age. I think he was a year or so older than our father. He was controlling. He's the father of the second kid she had. He was abusive to her. I just wanted to go from there to explain what happened within the week of when Jesse went missing.
So what led to your sister's drug addiction? I know that people usually have a reason. Maybe it's depression. Maybe they lost a loved one, and that's just the way that they cope. But it's not like they just do it for no reason. I think I had read something about her being deaf out of one ear and that she had a hard time coping and it possibly led to her depression. Is that correct?
No, Jesse was not affected by the hearing loss. It was only one ear. She was partially deaf. We don't even know if she was halfway deaf. It could have been when she was in school. If she wasn't sitting at the front or the middle of the class, she could not hear. So she was flunking. That was not what led her into depression. We think she was depressed, but being her sister, I always looked at it like, okay, what is she doing? She can't say there's a reason for this. This is her choice. But a lot of people in our family said Jesse was doing drugs because she felt like she was the sibling that always got in trouble. She felt like she was a failure because she didn't finish school. There was many things she was going through. We had lost a close family member. Around the same time, she had started doing drugs, but I feel like it was a whole lot altogether in her mind that led her down that path.
Did she come to you for help?
She never came to me for help. Jesse never really came to anyone for help getting off drugs. The only time she ever considered that was when something was serious. Jesse went into a gas station and was messing up, tearing up the store, freaking out. And they ended up taking her to the hospital for a detox thing. And we didn't know if Jesse was ODing. She was saying she was drugged and there was a Hispanic man after her. So there was a manager that worked at that gas station and she found me on the internet and she said, I just want to let you know I was the manager on duty at the gas station when your sister was there. And I do not know this lady, but she explained everything to me. And that's the only reason how I know that Jesse went in. And this is what she said, because the only thing we knew is what the police told us. They got her outside by the parking lot outside the gas station because someone had called saying, you know, disturbance. And they said she had torn the store up and was freaking out. So they needed to take her to the hospital. So up until that manager wrote me, we did not know what happened inside that gas station. Still to this day, we don't know if she was really ODing. It was never talked about after that. She had never said anything. When my mom would mention it, she wouldn't talk about it. That particular situation about her being at the gas station was the beginning of when everything happened during the first few days or so before Jesse went missing. She got sent to the hospital and she was there a little over 24 hours. My mom said she was able to sign herself out. I don't know how that works when it's a drug thing. So she left there and came home to my mom's. And within that same day, my mom said she went out to meet the boyfriend. She went with him to his house. And over the next 24 hours, we come to find out he had abused her at his house. And later on, when he got convicted in court, they used paperwork from when she went to the hospital from him beating her. It was considered legal documents because she went to the hospital for him severely beating her. So she met up with him and she was wherever with him and he did what he did to her, abusing her, and the next day dropped her off at my mom's house. So she goes into my mom's and she's like, Mom, can I have a pain pill? My mom back then, bad back problems. My sister's like, can I have a pill? And my mom would tell her, no, no. And Jesse would get mad. When my mom told her no, Jesse was like, Mom, come here, and went in her room with her. And she told her, she said, look. And she started pulling up her shirt. And that's when I walked in. And her whole body was just covered in bruises everywhere. my mom starts cussing and she's like, what happened to you? She thought when Jesse came in that she was just wanting to ask her, can I have a pill? So my mom told her, I'm calling the cops. And Jesse asked her, please don't call the cops. My mom called the cops. And from there, the paramedic and the cops came. And she told the paramedic at that time and the police officer what had happened. They took her to the hospital. So this is the second time she went to the hospital, because the first time was the gas station thing. So this time she went to the hospital because of the boyfriend abusing her. So Jesse had talked to the police officers, the paramedic. She talked to a social worker and the nurse that was taking care of her. She told them, my boyfriend did this. She said he had locked her in a room and he was beating her with a belt buckle. And in the pictures they took at the hospital, you could see the imprint from where he was beating her with the belt and all of the stuff they was able to use in court to convict him. He got locked up for a little over a month. So because she wasn't present, they had no case. Our detective said, I have all these people willing to come in and testify against him, such as the police officer, the paramedic, the nurses, and all of them. We have all the documents from when Jesse went to the hospital that day.
I know it's been 8 years, but it sounds like it was a traumatic experience for you, seeing Jessica being treated so badly by her boyfriend. And there's nothing you can do about it because she has to make her own decisions. And the only thing you can do is just watch it unfold and hope that she comes to her senses. It sounds like that even 8 years later, the wounds are still fresh in your mind.
Yes, everything that happened is fresh in our mind that same week. The last time we seen her, all that happened in the hospital kept her for a day or so. And she went home, she went to mom's, and Jesse had a history of drugs. So even the hospital, they're not going to give her anything for pain. They're not going to do that. They know what's going on. So she goes home, asks my mom for a pain pill. My mom says no. And my aunt was there and dropped her off over at my cousin's house. When Jesse left that day, none of us knew that was going to be the last time that we would ever see her. And she gets to my cousin and they get into a fight. I don't know what time they had got into a fight, but Jesse left from my cousin's house and walked down to the gas station down the street. Now, this gas station is right across the street from the first gas station I told you about where that first incident happened. So this is a completely different gas station, but it's directly across the street. And she goes in there and asks to use the phone. And she had called my brother and said, can you come get me? He said, what's going on? I'm on my way to work. I can't come right now. Jesse told my brother some people came at her wrong and someone wasn't treating her right or something was hurt, was what my brother told me. He told her that he couldn't come and get her for her to call mom. She never called my mom. And we know for sure she had called the boyfriend the couple days after she was on the missing persons list. He had called my mom's house one time and he said, have you guys heard from Jesse? We did not tell him anything when he called. So we're like, no, have you heard anything? When's the last time you talked to her? We were asking him a lot of questions, but, you know, playing everything cool. And he said, she called me from such and such gas station and told me she would be walking down Washington Street. And he said he drove up and down Washington Street all night or for hours is what he said. He said he never seen her and he never found her. And after that phone call, he never called again.
For this part of the story, I interviewed Detective Ron Cole of the Indianapolis Police Department. I asked him to share his thoughts about the case with me.
It's still very open, very active. They're still working on it. They haven't had any progress as to finding possibly where that person might be or anything more about her. They are actively working this case. She was reported missing at a given point, and they did a report after the protocols and so forth. that they're supposed to go to. And when they get it after 24 hours or whatever on an adult, they want to try to find who it is. And what they do is they contact anybody that had been around that particular individual within a day or two, friends, relatives, associates, and try to get a location of where the last person was that saw that particular individual. And when they do that, they'll combine all of those informational tasks and they'll try to locate that individual either at a home or at a hospital or a facility maybe where they went to. And a lot of times they'll find them at a friend's house that they were not supposed to be or things of this type. So it's an ongoing thing. And sometimes a person will be missing for a long time and all of a sudden they'll just pop up out of nowhere and not know exactly where they were. Nobody will know where they've been. And that's where the cases, especially with someone who has been missing as long as this person has, they may be in a hospital or a facility that's being treated and nobody knows where they're at.
When I spoke to the family about this case, they told me that Jessica would not just up and disappear because she kept in constant contact with her friends and family, and she had two kids. And I know that she had tried to call her brother that night.
Right.
And he wasn't able to pick her up. So once she left that gas station,
nobody has talked to her since then. And the officer that I talked to this morning said he did know who was assigned to her, because they had been reassigned due to different cases being moved out and different officers being coming in to the detective divisions. But that's the way that works, is they keep working at it as an active case until there's no leads that they can find, and then they'll put it in what they call a cold case. But right now, this is still a very active investigation.
One of the concerns from the family involves the boyfriend. She had been involved in domestic violence situations with him.
Yes.
And Christina told me that he used to call all the time, but then after her sister disappeared, they never heard from him again. It's as if he knew she wasn't coming back, and he's not reached out to the family for any updates about Jessica. And from what I understand, he's also the father of her second child. So don't you think that his behavior is kind of odd?
It's really not, because a lot of times they're going to be the first suspect that the officers are going to look at, detectives are going to look at, is somebody that's been in a domestic violence situation. They're going to be the first individual that gets looked at as where this person was or where this person was at. So it's not uncommon for that person just to disappear off the face of the earth for a while and then maybe contact later on. It's unusual with them having a child together that he's not tried to contact them unless he didn't want anything to do with the child. And that would be my first guess, is he doesn't want anything to do with the child, or he would be filing paperwork to show paternity that the child was his and he would like to get full custody of the child and things like that. And if he did something to her or knows where she's at, then the possibility that would even make it more relevant for him to even be looking for that particular individual. But it doesn't sound like that. If they have talked to him, then he's not a suspect at this point, because it's not been brought up to that particular issue. If he was a suspect, they'd be calling him in about every other week or two just to see if he had any contact with her or knew where she was at.
Now, what about the neighborhood that she disappeared from? From what I understand, it's a dangerous area. Is that correct?
It is a dangerous neighborhood, but it's not uncommon for some people, like in her position, and for the people that she was running around with at the time, to be involved in that neighborhood. And that, again, may be something where friends are, I'm not saying what friends are doing. That neighborhood is like, how to put this, a very close family, if you will. They don't talk about things. They don't want to let people know what's going on in the neighborhood. That's why we have a very difficult time in some neighborhoods, and even in our own town, as to find out what's going on. Normally, you can ask the kids. Well, recently, that's changed, because most of the kids in the neighborhood don't want to talk to the police because they think the police are bad. They think everything that they do is going to run right back to their parents, or they're going to get arrested, or they're going to get shot, they're going to get beat up. And that's where a lot of people now are not saying anything to the police about anything. And neighborhoods who are known to have drug activity or violent activity in situations, whether it's, you know, a meth lab in the neighborhood or a gang in the neighborhood, something like that, is going to be more quiet and not very outspoken to the police. So it's very hard for us to find that information out unless we can get somebody inside that neighborhood. And that neighborhood is not one of the worst ones in the city, but it is a bad neighborhood. To find someone missing in that neighborhood and then trying to find them again is one of the things where we look at the situation of asking door to door sometimes, canvassing the area to find out who saw her last, where she was with last. And they use all those informational tools that they get to try to locate and find her. And it's just the way that it works. It's a system. It's a very slow system sometimes. And in this case, it's been years since anything's been seen. So we don't know. Maybe she went to another city. Maybe she went to another state. We don't know.
I can also imagine that it makes it more challenging when a crime happens in a more dangerous neighborhood, when you're trying to find someone who will speak to the police. I've heard the same story from others that I have interviewed. So in many cases, if someone knows something, they aren't talking to the police.
You also get them in trouble as well. Somebody really talks to you. Sometimes that person's name gets back to the whole group as a snitch, and then they're outcast into that situation, and all kinds of problems start having with them. So you have to be careful when you are talking to people, even trying to find someone in a neighborhood such that she's in. But it's not uncommon for us to find things. And like I say, in an active case like they have, they're still looking at it from that standpoint that it is a very active case.
So my final question is, if anyone has information about Jessica's disappearance, who do they need to contact?
They need to call Crime Stoppers. That can be an anonymous call to them. And Crime Stoppers, if there's anything on any type of case, and like the podcast for the two girls out of Delphi that was involved, anytime you have something like that or they want to even contact the police department, they can call the non-emergency number at the IMPD, which is 317-327-3811. That's a non-emergency number. They can actually call the Crime Stoppers number and leave a voicemail as to, I know something about such and such being missing, Jessica being missing on such and such a date. Her location may be such and such, and this is an anonymous call, and leave it like that, because those calls are checked every day by the detectives assigned to different cases and so forth. And being a detective for 14 years myself, I've contacted the Crime Stoppers quite a bit just to see what's on their agenda. And if they have calls that come in every day on different cases, different things on, you check those to see if anything pertains to your case. And then you can follow up by either calling or going out to see an individual or going back to the neighborhood or talking to somebody else. It's like if I called you and said, hey, I know about Mrs. So-and-so. She was last seen on October 31st at the Village Pantry about 9 p.m. I was there, but I don't want to leave my name. Now, they would go back then to that particular business and say, okay, 9 p.m., such and such a date. Do you remember this particular individual? And there's a lot of things that they will follow up on. So it's not just things that they throw away and dismiss as a not effective to that case. But they take anonymous phone calls and try to get the best information out of that phone call as they can.
Is that Indianapolis Crime Stoppers?
Yes, there's a national number that they can also call that gives you any case anywhere. It's just like Crime Stoppers, Indianapolis, Indiana, on such and such case, and they would put that right in there, and then it would come back to that detective who is assigned to that particular case to follow up on it. We all hope for the best, and sometimes it is good when a turn comes out. And sometimes it's not, but hopefully they can find her and make sure that she's safe.
For this part of the story, I spoke to Kiera, who is one of Jessica's closest friends. So tell me about how you first met Jessica and when you both became friends.
Me and Jesse first met, I was probably like 10 or 11. So here in Indianapolis, skating was a really big thing. And I met her first when we were skating together. We skate a lot. And then I knew some of her other friends through the neighborhood that she used to live in. And then after that, like, we just always went skating together. We were always together, hung out every freaking weekend up until we were about 15 or 16-ish. And then we started like growing apart. I started, you know, getting really heavy into learning about the military, preparing for that in high school. And we went to different high schools. So I went to Warren, she went to Manual. So, you know, we didn't hang out as much, but we did still hang out a lot. Again, skating, we skated all the way up till probably I graduated high school. Even after I got back from the military, any chance I got, I was skating. So most of our years were spent when we were really young. I would hang out at her house, spend the night at her house. My mom worked a lot, so I would stay the night with friends. So we grew up together in the skating rink pretty much, and watching all her younger siblings grow up. I was like their big sister. So growing up with all of them and seeing them all grow up. But like I said, we started growing apart more in the essence of, like, you know, she was just doing different things than I was. So it wasn't like there was anything bad between us, like we didn't like each other or anything like that. It was just more like, you know, I started getting prepared to go to the military. I got 16, 17. I was looking into ROTC and doing ROTC and stuff and getting prepared for that. And she was doing other things, different things than I was doing. We just didn't do things as closely anymore. So we just naturally kind of grew apart in that way. But anytime she needed anything, she'd call me. I'd go pick her up, go see how she's doing. As far as around the time, me and her sister were actually talking about this today. As far as like when she went missing, I don't know, it's just still surreal for me, I guess. So me and her were talking about, there was a point, right, I think it had to have been like a month or two before she had her second child, which is right before she went missing. So probably about 2 months is what we're calculating-ish before she went missing. And she had to have called me, because otherwise I wouldn't have known how to get to where she was, because I'd never been to that place before. So she called me, and you know, I don't really remember the conversation or whatever. It was 8 years ago, but I don't remember exactly what she said to me. But all I do remember is me coming there, and she had her oldest with her, so her other son. She had him with her, and she had originally come out to my car. So she had called me, come out to the car, was talking to me, hey, you know, normal, which she does. She'll call any of her family members, hey, how you doing? So she came out to the car and she was talking to me for a little bit. And I was like, oh, where's little Travis? She's like, he's upstairs. So I did kind of talk her into letting me come upstairs, because I know that area is kind of known for where we were. I knew that area was known for like just different type, you know, it's a bad area. So I just wanted to make sure he was okay. I mean, I know that it's not strictly like rough houses, but I just know it's either, you know, usually Section 8 living where mom is just trying to get on her feet. She has kids. She might have, you know, she at least has some food in the fridge. Beds, you know, it might be a rough living condition, but at least her kids are bathed. So I wanted to kind of see what was going on, because she had my nephew there. I go upstairs and there's no door on the bathroom. There's barely any toilet paper. Couch is like duct taped together. So this is where I'm trying to pinpoint. So in this year, there was a huge blizzard that year. So that's where I need to look back on like Google or something. Me and her literally was talking about this earlier, and that's the part I need to research, is when that blizzard happened, because that's the day for that blizzard. That's when I went and picked her son up. So I tried to talk her into coming with me and saying, hey Jess, you know, you can stay a night with me. She had never been to my new house, because at this point I was living in a different place in Fountain Square. So I kind of talked her into like coming with me. Hey, you know, you can come stay the night. I'd feed her, you know, or whatever, and she could come stay with me, just to get her out of where she was at. And she refused to come with me. Like, she would not come. She would not leave. She didn't want to go anywhere. But I did end up talking her into letting me take Junior with me. So her son came back with me that night, and then we got snowed in. So I talked to his dad. I ended up calling his dad and telling him, you know, Junior's with me. Me and Travis, I've known Travis forever too. Her, the father of her first child. And so that's another thing. Like, growing up, when they were together, we were always hanging out. I spent a lot of time over there with them when they were together. So I called him and just let him know, like, hey, you know, I have Junior, just so you're not freaking out or worried about him. If you need anything or, you know, whatever, call me and let me know. It was really late, and I just didn't want him staying in that environment, because I literally, like, just the condition that it was, I figured there's probably no food here. There's probably nothing. I don't want him sleeping on this couch. I didn't see a bed, but like a mattress with no sheet or anything on it, like a twin size mattress. So I talked her into letting me take him. Again, we got snowed in, and so I called Travis again, and I said, don't know if you're able to get out in this, but I can't get out anywhere in this snow. You know, he understood. He was like, no, sis, I understand. I had already went and got him plenty of kid food, because this was before my child was born. So as soon as I had gotten him that night, I went to the store and got food. I ended up keeping him for like 2 nights until the blizzard kind of passed, and we were able to like drive in it, and then I ended up driving him to his dad. And that's the last time I physically saw her. And then it wasn't until her sister and them and their mom called me and was like, she's missing. Has she called you? Hadn't heard from her. No text, no calls, nothing. Of course, I went over there with the family, and we all passed, you know, that first week we all passed out flyers. We went knocking on doors. We went searching through woods. We went, you know, the whole nine yards. As we talk about it, it's just like, she's not that type of person. You know, that we have people that are like, oh, well, what if she wanted to go missing? What if she wanted to disappear? I don't know the second boyfriend. I never met him before. I just have heard all the horror stories about him, and I've seen like how malnourished he was and stuff when I went to pick Junior up that night. But, you know, I've never met him, so I don't know his personality. I don't know if he's able to talk her into this or that. I don't know what kind of relationship they have. I just know her.
I just know she's not the type of person to just up and disappear and just go somewhere and not contact anybody in her family.
I got the impression that Jessica would not be someone who would just walk away from her children, friends, or family. So something must have happened to her to prevent her from returning home. That's my opinion.
Yeah. And I've tried to like run through several different scenarios. Okay, let's say that somebody talked her into leaving her kids because they were in danger or the boyfriend threatened her or whatever. Even if that was the case and she removed herself from her children, I still feel that any chance she gets, she'd be reaching out to one of us, whether it be direct family, sister, brother, mother, or extended family, me, Amanda, some of the other very close friends, or people that she grew up in the two neighborhoods that she was predominantly grown up in, that she would reach out to somebody because that's how she was. That's how we are. So I just don't see her completely falling off the map and nobody's like, she's not contacted anybody. We've ran through, so what if this happened or what if that happened? And obviously at this point, that's the only thing we can do is try to, we even tried, this lady had reached out to us, I think probably like 2 years in. She was the psychic and took us down this whole road with, we had like searched the railroad tracks and it was pretty traumatic, I think, for Christina and them. I had prayed about it before I went there and I did my own thing. God, show me this. If this is not accurate or if this is not what we should be following, show me X, Y, and Z signs. And while I was out there randomly on train tracks, I saw those signs. God showed me clearly that this lady was not who she said she was, in so many words. And so I was still there to support them, but I didn't feed into what that lady, like this lady took them down and was telling her mom, oh my God, her bones are here. Like had them digging barehanded in the dirt and everything. Like it was very traumatic.
Believe me, there are definitely a lot of strange people out there. I know because I get contacted by a lot of them.
For me, my thing was just that, you know, because she puts on a strong face. Hell, I put on a strong face. But at the end of the day, it's harder not knowing what happened versus somebody knowing what happened to your family. You know what I mean? It's a lot tougher just not, you know, being clueless and not knowing what happened.
Over the course of doing this podcast, I've talked to so many different people. And I think that it's tough when somebody takes your loved one away and you don't know what happened to them. They're missing. If someone murders them, you can recover a body. You still wonder who killed them, but at least you know they're no longer alive anymore. Just think that if they're missing and you spend years not knowing what happened to them, you don't know if they were abducted or if they died. I think that that would be just torture if I was a family member like Christina's family.
And that's the hard thing about it. Like even her mom, you know, she's one of many kids. And, you know, after like 2 years, you know, people started coming to her mom like, oh, well, you have other kids to live for. You need to move on and stuff like that. I just wanted to like wring these people's necks because I'm like, I don't care. I have 3 kids of my own. I don't care if I have 50 kids. You're not going to tell me to just get over my child and not knowing, have no type of closure. If she got killed or if she got kidnapped or if she got this or that, like at least knowing that it's still a hard pill to swallow, but at least you'd have some type of closure to know that she's alive or she's not alive. Are we giving up on her? Or are we not giving? You know what I mean? Like, is she still out there? Because, you know, me and Christina were talking about the case. I think it happened in Ohio. The two young women that got found in that house.
Yeah, that case, I'm familiar with it. It happened up in Cleveland when Ariel Castro abducted Amanda Berry, Michelle Knight, and Gina De Jesus. He had kept them locked up in his basement for years and tormented them. Oh, that was a horrible story. Their families probably thought that they were all deceased and had given up.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we were talking about stuff like that. Like, what if her, you know, the other boyfriend or whatever, if he had one of his friends kidnap her and take her somewhere and she's still out there somewhere and we don't know where she is, you know, and she's still alive. Do we still keep trying? Do we still, of course, every day we're still trying. We still try to put her story out there. We still try to put flyers up twice a year, you know, around her birthday, around this time. Ashley's usually putting something together right before school starts for us to put out more flyers. But it's like, are we, you know, doing it in vain or are we, it's really hard. That's the hardest part about it is not knowing. And then people just being cruel with her mom, like reaching out. A lot of people had more access to her mom when it first happened. You know, they're inboxing her and had her cell phone up, you know, because her mom didn't know exactly what she was opening herself up to, putting her information out there that there are freaking weirdos out there that do stupid stuff, and they don't care what you're going through because they're prank calling her and all kinds of stuff. That breaks my heart too, is just to know that as a mom, that people are like telling that you should give up on your kid. Like, I can't imagine that.
I've never told anyone that's lost someone that you need to just get over it. It's just something that everybody grieves differently. And a lot of times when you lose someone, it's something that you just don't ever get over. I mean, I can tell you, for instance, that my grandfather died over 20 years ago and my father passed away in April. I will never get over either one of them.
Even if she knew what happened, Jesse, I can't imagine telling her, oh, well, you know, you have other kids to live for. But her not knowing, I know that has to be killing her, because one of her best friends, it messes with me. Even being around Christina and them sometimes, because they look so much like Jessica, it messes with me. Like, it messes with my head. Like, just seeing how much Christina, she's like almost identical, like a twin to Jesse. And then having to be strong for her. Sometimes I get around her and me and her just both bawling and crying and a hot mess. And I try to do better each time I'm around her because I want to be supportive. I want to be strong for you and not make you sad at the same time because I'm sad. So I can only imagine it has to be like a million times worse for her mother, not knowing, not having answers, not, you know. And then you have cruel ass people that call her and are tormenting her. First, like 2 years, all this happened, you know, that's the kind of what I, you know, everything that I saw from the beginning and stuff. And like I said, Jesse might have not made the best choices sometimes. And there's things that she's had to battle through. Everybody has their demons and stuff like that. But she just wasn't the person to just up and disappear. Like, at some point, she's calling somebody within the circle. Her circle was too big for her not to reach out to somebody.
In your opinion, what do you think happened to Jessica?
Honestly, I really couldn't tell you. Like, because, again, like, in that point in time, we weren't hanging out as tough as we were before. So I don't want to say my judgment being clouded, because, like, when it first happened, it was like, oh, it's the boyfriend. Oh, no, it's the cousin. I honestly can't say what I think happened, because I don't know. I really don't know. In my opinion, she either got like caught up with somebody that, you know, I know I've heard that she was in argument with one of our cousins and then she left and she was just walking around. My theories are one or two things, is that she left out of there upset and either tried to get a ride from somebody to somewhere else and got swooped up in like sex trafficking or something, or that somebody did something to her, like the boy that, because they said she was trying to get to her boyfriend, either he took her somewhere or one of his friends took her. But again, I don't know him well enough to know, you know what I'm saying? Like, I never met him. I never seen him. And I'm one of those people that I can usually be around somebody for the, you know, like the first time meeting them or seeing them and kind of be able to read their vibe pretty clearly, if that makes sense, like energy wise. And I just never got the chance to meet him. That's why I took Junior that day, because I was like, okay, the energy here, no child should be here. You're a grown adult. You know, if you want to stay here, that's fine. I'm not going to drag you out of here. I'm not your mom or your dad, but I'm taking the baby. Like, I did talk her into letting me take Junior home with me, just because I felt, you know, that environment was not safe for him. It wasn't a good environment for him, but, you know, and I'm glad I did, because if they would have got stormed in, he wouldn't have nothing to eat. My two theories is either she just was in the wrong place at the wrong time or something, and somebody lured her into sex trafficking, or her boyfriend or somebody close to that scenario took her somewhere and has her, or they got into it and she fought her or something. I don't know. I know that Christina said that she also had just had a C-section from having the baby, and that maybe she got into a fight with somebody or somebody got an argument or something, and she, you know, they injured her incisions or something like that. Again, I don't know. I didn't see her after having the baby or anything to know well enough to know that. So if I had to take a shot in the dark, for me, it would probably be the sex trafficking that she got caught up because of the area she was in when she went missing.
The last question that I would have for you is, what are your final thoughts about Jessica? Tell me what she meant to you and what she still means to you to this day.
I would say that she's one of my best friends. It's really hard to explain that. I feel that everybody deserves to have a chance, you know, to have life no matter what demons they're fighting. To me, it's like, I feel like I have to live twice as hard now, because that could have easily been any of us. for me, it's, even though I didn't make some of the same choices that she made, that I still know people that we love and care about that are fighting those demons. I still see people on my timeline on Facebook that are fighting these demons. And that doesn't mean just because they have a different lifestyle or that they're fighting things that people don't know about or that they don't have the same support systems that some of us have grown up with, that they don't deserve to live, that they don't deserve to have a chance at life, that they don't have, that their children shouldn't be able to grow up knowing who they are and knowing how much they were loved by them, you know? But she was my best friend.
For the conclusion of the story, Jessica Masker, I spoke to her sister Christina to get her final thoughts about her sister.
With Jesse, we continue to tell people they pulled up my mother's phone records from this guy, just his phone number. And it's creepy because this man, like 50 some years old, this is weird. This is scary. He called my mom's house hundreds of times. All the time, we'd say Jesse's using the restroom or Jesse went to the gas station or she is in the shower, and he continuously called. And then he called that one time and never called again. Never, not one time, have any of us heard from. I've said this to people so many times. As much as I talk about this boyfriend, this drug provider, I think he had something to do with this. I really do. Even though I think I will never, ever put past me that something else could have happened to her, because there are so many times that I think this could have happened or that could have happened, because you sit here and you think this could have happened or this could have happened. It messes up your mind, because who wants to think about all of these things that could have happened to my sister? And I just get to sitting there and thinking she's gone. She's not here. And it's hard. How do you grieve? Of a missing family member. We never got to say goodbye.
In your opinion, do you think that there's any possibility that your sister is still alive?
In my heart, no. But in my mind, I honestly feel like this is a horrible state we live in. Anything could have happened to my sister.
So is it mainly you that's looking for your sister, or is this something where the entire family is working together to try to bring Jessica home?
So everyone helped. It just got hard on my mom. My mom got to a breaking point. My mom talked to a detective about 5 days a week. And after a few years, that detective had retired. And around that time, my mom felt like it was the end of us having a backup. The person that came in as the new detective, my mom never can get through to him. He never responds to her. I think it was within 3 or 4 years after she was missing, he became her detective and this new one. And my mom's maybe talked to him maybe 3 or 4 times. I just think within that time frame after the first detective went retired, I feel like around that time, my mom started to give up hope on her daughter. It just takes a person that cares, who that you feel like is there and that's helping a lot. Like this past candle lighting that we just had, a candle lighting and a lantern release. One of my brothers was out of state. He's in the military, so he couldn't be here. It's just hard. I feel like I have to be the stronger one for everyone.
So what about the boyfriend? It's been 8 years. Have you seen him or talked to him lately?
No. When he was in prison, whatever, they would not let the detectives or anyone talk to him about Jesse missing. So once he got out, the detective got a hold of my mom. Hey, he's out. We found out where he is. We're going to go and talk to him. And then my mom's like, okay, her mind was going again. Maybe we might get somewhere. And they went to talk to him. And he told them, unless you have something on me, I don't have nothing to say to you. And he won't talk to them at all. I have not seen him. My mother told me about 2 years ago that she seen him at a hospital in the waiting room, and she didn't know how to react. So she's kind of lost herself a little bit. She started yelling at him, and I'm sure they removed her from the hospital. But I didn't believe it when I was told that she seen him. And When I was told that, I just panicked. I just got this weird feeling. I felt like she wasn't safe. You know, there's people there, like, she's got to be okay. I had this weird feeling take over my whole body, and I'm like, oh my God, like, she did see him. It just hit me, and I'm like, this isn't real. I didn't think any of us would ever see him again. And then when you see that person, it's just like, I wouldn't know what to think. I don't know.
To me, it sounds highly suspicious that he just stops contacting your family anymore. So when Jessica is around, he's calling constantly, but then he just abruptly stops looking for her or calling about her. It's almost as if he knows that she's no longer around.
Right. And that's why I felt like in the beginning he was controlling. He knew what he was doing. He was twice her age. He was trying to take control of her and off that last little phone call. I'm a type of person, I keep trying to dig in and find stuff out. And I continued thinking, this man has never called again. Not one time. Like, nothing. It didn't make no sense to me. And then seeing him in court or whatever, because like I said, Jesse was already missing, and having to go to court and see him sitting there. At this point, we know he beat Jesse, but we don't know if he did anything to her. We don't know anything. So when we were in court, the judge looked directly at him and said, how do I know that you didn't kill this girl? Because they tried bringing up the fact that my cousin, the one whose house she was at before they got into a fight at, and she left from there and, you know, went to that gas station. That's the last time anyone heard from her. That cousin had used Jesse's name. I guess they call it an alias or whatever. Jesse was already missing. So it was after April 15th. And they had to bring that up and show Jessica had never been to jail. She had never gotten in trouble, none of that. So they were able to rule that out because they tried saying, well, if she was missing, then why was she just in jail? And they're like, they had to prove that wrong first. And then they brought all of them people in to testify against him. And like I was saying, the judge looked at him and said, you know, how do I know that you didn't do something to this girl? I think he was trying to do a fast and speedy. It's where they speed everything up and try to get it over with. And that's one of the reasons why the judge told him, from seeing these pictures and what they did to her, and they're just showing everyone in this courtroom, and this man is just sitting here with a straight face, looking like a normal person. He looks so mean. I want to make sure I go back to saying, I will never only think that this man did something, because anything could have happened to her. I mean, she just had a baby previously, within 2 months before, and she was doing drugs. She had an incision where she had the C-section. I mean, there's so many things that could have happened, and I don't know. None of it sits right with me. The day that she went missing, when she was at that gas station, she had called my brother and then called the boyfriend or whatever. The detectives had got in contact with my cousin, too, and said, we want to talk to you. And she talked to him. They had said they didn't think anything was coming about with her. They didn't think there was any suspicious with her, because she told them about the fight and she knew what time it was when Jesse had left her house when they got into it. And so they checked the cameras of the gas station that she went to around the time frame our cousin said she left. And they seen Jesse on the cameras at this gas station when she made the phone call and when she left. They said that when she was there on the camera, she was not seen talking to anyone, and she was never seen going up to anyone's car or anyone coming up to her in their car the whole time she was on the camera. They never seen her get in the car with anyone. They never seen her talk to anyone. So we do know that she made it past this gas station after the phone call. So whether or not that boyfriend found her, it's either between him or something else happened that night when she was walking down the street. My brother said it was in between 4 and 5 a.m. when she had called him from that gas station. So I'm thinking around 4 or 5 a.m. walking down Washington Street on the southeast side of Indianapolis. This area is considered well-known prostitution and drug area. So not a safe area, even if it was 5 a.m. Crazy stuff, drugs and snatching people up and everything else is still happening around 4 and 5 a.m. So there's so many things that could have happened. And it's the way our family has to think and relive this, just sitting here and thinking, like, what is she going through? What happened to her? If she is still here, whatever she's going through has been horrible. She's not safe because she's not out there by herself anymore. Even in the beginning, she would have talked to someone. She knows so many people. She would have said something. She's a person that always had either a cell phone, a pager, a house phone, something. She was always on the phone, on the computer, on the internet. She never was without. That's one of the things that we didn't understand when she went missing, because she didn't have any of that. We knew right away she was missing because she had to go see the baby at a hospital every single day. She had to do this in order to get her baby. And she did not go see him. And that's how we knew. So that's when we started looking, asking around, how everything started with us calling the cop. It's a lot to explain in just a very short time frame to someone because of what happened to her. You know, everyone was just thinking, oh, she's this young girl and doing drugs. She's still my sister. She has been still a person. She's kids. She has a mother. No matter what she was doing, she was our person. So for people to judge, and people make mistakes. People will accidentally do something one time and then that's it for them. So you cannot give up on people like this. As much as my mom disagreed and hated what Jesse was doing, the drugs and stuff, she was not giving up on her. She welcomed her in her house no matter what she did or how late she came in or if she stole. Her doors were always open. My mom beats herself up about stuff because she feels like she was too harsh on Jesse. But she feels like the times up leading right before her disappearance, that maybe she was too harsh. I understand people that do drugs, you don't want them around your kids. And that's understandable. But just let that person know you still love them, that they still have you. Because there's point in times that they have too much going and they run to these drugs. I have friends right now that have siblings that they're not missing, but they're actively doing drugs. And they don't know how to fathom it. And it's easy for me to talk to them about it and explain, hey, I'm not, you know, trying to be this kind of person, but maybe we can try this. I don't want to make it seem like I'm trying to be like, I understand this so much, because I don't know where my sister is. If I can be that extra ear to listen to someone, or that extra mouth to be able to talk to someone about this kind of situation and let them know, don't shut these people out. I feel like a lot of people's mindset would look at these situations differently.
I find your experience really troubling. I mean, I don't have missing brothers, so I don't know what you're going through, and I can't even imagine how you or your family feels by not knowing where Jessica is. But you are right. People are very judgmental, and I've spoken to people that are in the same situation as you, and they feel like if their loved one was on drugs or had some type of criminal past, it's almost like, well, they're not really worth looking for. But like you just said, that person is loved by someone. It's still someone's son. It's still someone's daughter, someone's mother. And as long as you're alive, you have a chance to turn things around. There's people that have been on drugs and alcoholics, and they have overcome those demons and managed to turn their lives around. It happens to a lot of people. But if your sister is still alive, there's a chance that she can turn her life around. But if she's not here anymore, she no longer has that chance. But I think that as long as someone's alive, there's always hope. And without hope, you don't have anything.
Yes, for sure. I tell my mom all the time, because she knows what I'm talking about. I say, Mom, you can't stop living.
Well, you're absolutely right. Your family, you guys can't just die. You have to keep looking. You have to pull up rocks. You have to call the police. You have to contact the media. You have to do what you can to try to bring your sister home. You just can't give up. Every day is a new struggle, but you got to do it because you love her and she's family, and you just have to do what you have to do. So the last question that I would have for you is for anyone out there that's listening to the podcast, if they know anything about what happened to Jessica, what would you say to that person or persons?
I would say, I hope that after this long that you would have the courage to come forward. Everyone knows nowadays you can talk and it can get around and it can come out and be known. You don't have to tell anyone that it can be not completely anonymous. I want listeners to know that about Jesse's disappearance, that she is still missing. I want people to share it, talk about it. That's going to be one of the main things that I feel like at this point, since it's been so long, that's what's going to be able to break something at this point with her case, because that's honestly all I feel like that we have right now. And no one's talking. I feel like a lot of people have helped with sharing it, things that I have had online, but please just keep talking about it so people know she's not home. It's been 8 years since I've heard or seen my sister. Any small thing that someone talks about or anything could be something so big, a case like this, such as Jesse's. Just pay close attention to situations with young women and children, because the world that we live in now is not how it used to be. And anything can happen in a matter of a second. Your awareness could save a life. Sadly, if Jesse was still out there, I know she's not safe. And I just want Jesse to know I'm here and I will never give up on her.
And that concludes the story of Jessica Masker. Do you know what happened to her? Her family is highly concerned about her whereabouts. No one just disappears into thin air. If you know anything about her disappearance, please contact the Indianapolis Police Department at 317-327-6184, or you can contact Indianapolis Crime Stoppers at 317-262-TIPS. Or Crime Stoppers USA at 1-800-222-TIPS. And if you want to learn more about this case, please visit the Charlie Project website or the Where Is My Sister Jessica Masker Facebook page. I will also include this information in the podcast story notes. And if you are a parent, law enforcement official, friend, or relative seeking justice for an unsolved homicide case, please visit my website and complete the contact form, or contact me through Facebook. Thank you for listening.